This is the WGBH Forum Network.
John Furling is an emeritus professor of history at the University of West Georgia. He brings to this book nearly 40 years of experience as a historian of early America. He's the author of 9 books and numerous articles on the American Revolution and early American wars, and has appeared in 4 television documentaries devoted to the Revolution and the War of Independence. I heard that. His book, A Leap in the Dark, which we have available for you, also won the 2003 Francis Tavern Board Book Award as the year's best book on the American Revolution, as that year's best book. He and his wife live in metropolitan Atlanta. It's my pleasure to present John Furling. After the lecture. After the lecture, give him a few minutes to get out there so he can sign books for you. You can pick them up then. Thank you. John? Thank you, sir.
I'm honored to be invited to speak at the Atlanta History Center, and even more honored to be invited back. I spoke here in 2004, and it's a delight to be back again. When I was working on my book on the War of Independence, I was surprised at how many of my attitudes changed about the Revolutionary War. I think I came to appreciate that the war was a much tougher war for soldiers on all sides than I had realized. I came to understand just how close at the end of the war America came, if not to losing the war, at least to not winning the war. And my attitudes changed toward a number of the more important figures in the war. I think I came to have less respect for General Horatio Gates than I had had previously, and I came to have more respect for Nathaniel Greene and Henry Knox and Charles Lee, among others. But I think maybe what surprised me the most was that my attitudes changed somewhat toward General Washington. In the end, I concluded that Washington was the best choice, the best man for the position as Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army, and that America was fortunate to have had him as the commander. But I also, I think, was somewhat surprised to see just how many mistakes Washington made, and especially in the latter years of the war, which tend to be forgotten by a great many people. So that the title of my talk tonight is General George Washington, Fortunate to Have Had Him, Lucky to Have Survived Him. And I'll try to explain as I go along what I'm thinking of in that regard. Near the end of the war, Washington wrote a farewell address to the Continental Army, and in that address, Washington expressed his surprise at America's victory. So surprised, in fact, that he characterized the victory as little short of a standing miracle, as he put it. And a month later, when he appeared before Congress and resigned his commission as commander of the Continental Army, Washington attributed America's victory to 3 things. National unity had been crucial. He had an outstanding corps of officers, he said, and the hand of God had played no small role in America's victory. Interestingly, he didn't mention France, which had helped quite a bit. And quite surprisingly, he ignored the 100,000 men who served in the Continental Army and about 200,000 who served in the militia during the war. All around America, there were celebrations, of course, for the America's victory. And in the years that followed the war, there would be celebrations and commemorative meetings on anniversaries of battles and other occasions. And at those anniversaries, the American people attributed their victory to French help, to common soldiers, to the spirit that had sustained the revolution. But over and above everything else, they tipped their hat to General Washington. Washington was the reason for America's victory, contemporaries came to believe. And in fact, I think not only was Washington perhaps the most esteemed American of all time in his lifetime, but he continues to be lionized today. When Washington passed away in 1799, there were mock funerals all around the country. The most famous was in the Lutheran Church in Philadelphia, which was still the national capital. And in probably the most famous eulogy delivered on Washington, Colonel Henry Lee, Light Horse Harry Lee, uttered the most memorable line. Washington, he said, had been first in war, first in peace, and first in the hearts of his countrymen. On the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence in 1826, the great triumvirate of the Revolution, Washington, John Adams, and Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson was exalted as the pen of the Revolution, Adams as the voice of the Revolution, and Washington as the sword of the Revolution. During the Civil War, Washington served as an inspiration to both Union and Confederate soldiers. And in our time, meaning in the last 40 or 50 years, historians have continued to exalt Washington. James Thomas Flexner, in his four-volume biography of Washington written in the 60s and 70s, called Washington the indispensable man of the American Revolution. And David McCullough, in his acclaimed book 1776 that came out a couple of years ago, wrote, "Without Washington's leadership and unrelenting perseverance, the Revolution almost certainly would have failed." So it's a big task to try to take on Washington and see Washington's faults, but that's what I'm proposing to do in my talk tonight. No American commander ever got off to a better start than George Washington. And let me refresh your memory just a bit about the start of the Revolutionary War. It began at Lexington and Concord on April 19, 1775, when the British sent a 900-man force out to destroy a colonial arsenal. Shots were fired, blood was shed on both sides. The war began. Very quickly, however, alerted by dispatch riders like Paul Revere, hundreds, even thousands of colonists descended on Concord and then on Boston to fight the British. And in fact, within only hours of the shooting at Lexington and Concord, the entire British Army, virtually the entire British Army in North America, 6,000-man army, was trapped in Boston by a 16,000 man American army composed entirely of New Englanders, and they called their army the Grand American Army. But New England knew that it could not fight this war by itself, and they shouldn't have to fight the war by itself. Other colonies were oppressed by Great Britain as well, and so the New England delegates to the Continental Congress asked Congress to create a national army. And Congress did that 2 months after the shooting at Lexington and Concord. They changed the name of the army from the Grand American Army to the Continental Army, and in mid-June 1775 named George Washington as the commander of that army. Washington hurried to Boston and took command of the siege army there. And Washington inherited a very fortunate situation. The British were trapped. They couldn't get out of Boston. They couldn't go anywhere. And while we deservedly think of American soldiers suffering through the Revolutionary War, the British soldiers that first winter had it worse than the Americans did. They had very little food, very little firewood. It was a long, tough winter for the British. So tough, in fact, that before very long, both London and the British commander, General William Howe, decided that Britain would have to abandon Boston. They didn't announce that publicly, of course, and in fact the British Army would have probably been gone before Christmas, but they didn't have the ships to leave. So they waited for transports to come, and they were still waiting for those transports to come when Washington got enough artillery pieces from Fort Ticonderoga and took his army atop Dorchester Heights overlooking Boston. And the British then found that the Boston Harbor, their lifeline to the homeland, was vulnerable. And the British negotiated a pact with Washington: if you will let us leave Boston unmolested, we will go. And so the British left. They did what they had decided months before to do, but it appeared to most Americans to be a great bloodless triumph by George Washington. In fact, the city government in Boston congratulated Washington on the success of your military operations, and Congress had a medal struck in Washington's honor, a gold medal that showed Washington sitting astride his horse, watching those British ships sail over the horizon, leaving Boston and ending the occupation of the city. So Washington had a lucky break in his first campaign. But things did not go so well after that. Washington took his army down to New York, and it's the campaign of New York in 1776 where Washington's war really begins. Washington was eager for the campaign of New York. In fact, later on the legend developed, and Washington, I think, helped sow that legend, that he was made by Congress to defend New York. But that's not true. There's no evidence that Congress forced Washington to do that. Washington, in fact, was a fighter. He had been denied a battle in Boston. He was eager to fight. He had had a year to train his army, and he believed that his army was capable of standing up to British regulars. So Washington went into battle in New York, and when he did, many things went wrong. Before I look at what did go wrong in New York, let me say one thing in Washington's defense, and that is Washington was not a professional soldier. He wasn't chosen because he was a professional. In fact, there were no professional soldiers, at least who had been born in America, around. Washington had soldiered for 5 years for a Virginia army in the French and Indian War, but his fighting had been a kind of fighting that British regulars called bush warfare. That is, he was fighting out on the frontier against the Indians. Very different kind of fighting than he would be up against in the Revolutionary War. Washington was chosen for other reasons. Washington had some military experience. He was the right age. He was 43 years old, old enough to be mature, but young enough to be likely to survive a long war. He had been a member of Congress, First and Second Continental Congress, and the congressmen were wary about turning over military authority to any man. They had read enough history that they knew all through history there were too many instances of generals abusing their power and becoming despots. But they had spoken, interviewed Washington in a sense in those two Congresses, and talked with other Virginia delegates, and they believed that they could trust Washington. They also chose Washington because he was not a New Englander. And in fact, it was a New Englander, John Adams, who nominated him, in large measure because they felt if they were to have a national army, They had to get someone from outside New England who could build that national army. And finally, Washington was an imposing figure. He had a reputation for athleticism. He was a powerfully built man, 6'3" tall, 210 pounds when he weighed for the first time when he was 50 years old. With that physique, Washington would probably be a top athlete today, maybe a quarterback in the NFL. In fact, there's a job open. if he could ollie him back. So Washington goes down to New York, confident of victory, and made many, many mistakes in New York. He made the fundamental mistake that's just fundamental in military tennis. He divided his army in the face of a superior adversary. He changed his commanders, literally on the eve of battle. He permitted his subordinates to redeploy much of his army, moving them out of entrenchments that his soldiers had painstakingly constructed over nearly 8 months. He failed to secure the roads that led behind his army. And when the battle began, he fell for the oldest trick in the book. General Howe attacked the center of Washington's army, and Washington believed that that was the principal attack. It was, however, a feint. And Howe took the bulk of his army up one of those roads that Washington had not secured, got behind the Continental Army, and in a very short engagement, destroyed about 15% of Washington's men. The rest of the men fled in a pell-mell retreat to the entrenchments at Brooklyn Heights. And they probably would have never gotten out of there had General Howe resolutely attacked them. But Howe waited. He wanted more information. He wanted more equipment and more men. And he waited too long. A late August storm blew up, and in the rain and dense fog that settled over Long Island, Washington was able to extricate his men while the British Navy was shut down. And Washington moved his army back to Manhattan and presumably to safety. But he no more than got his army back on Manhattan than he committed the same blunder. He divided his army once again, putting three quarters of his army up in Harlem Heights, about 12 miles or so above the city, and the other quarter of his army at the southern tip of Manhattan in the city itself. So what did General Howe do? General Howe landed in between the two divisions of Washington's army, around 34th Street in present-day Manhattan. And again, had Howe moved resolutely and quickly, the British could have crossed the entire narrow Manhattan Island, sealing off every road as it went, and dooming that one quarter of Washington's army in New York City. But again, the British moved slowly. Some of the British, the story went, paused to brew pots of tea, and while they waited, the Americans wiggled out of the trap. Many Americans were outraged by what had happened. A colonel in a Pennsylvania regiment who nearly got killed on Long Island said, "Less generalship never was shown in any army since the art of war was understood." And the commander of a Delaware regiment after Long Island exclaimed that the vast burden appears too much for a man of Washington's limited experience. Even non-soldiers were aghast at what had occurred. John Adams, who had never soldiered and was a member of Congress in Philadelphia, was perplexed when Washington divided his armies and wrote in his diary, "They must keep their force together. The instant they divide, they are ruined." And after Long Island and after this first engagement on Manhattan, Adams railed in his diary about the negligence and incapacity of the leaders of the army. "There is a dearth of genius among them," Adams said. But Washington's worst errors in New York were yet to come. He was on Manhattan, which is an island. He had no navy, and he was up against the British Navy, which was the best navy in the world in the 18th century. In addition to that, Washington had a pretty good idea what General Howe was going to do. In mid-September, Washington wrote that Howe intended to land his force, his army, above Manhattan on the mainland and cut off all communication between city and country, thereby reducing us to the necessity of fighting our way out, said Washington. Washington even predicted that if Howe made that landing, he would cut this army in pieces, as he put it. And in another letter, Washington said that if Howe made that landing, the Continental Army would face three options, all bad. It would have to fight its way out under every disadvantage, or it would have to surrender at discretion, or it would have to starve. So one would think, knowing that that was likely to happen, Washington would have taken his army off of Manhattan. By this time, Congress had specifically authorized him to do so, and a council of war, Washington's leading generals, had voted to do so. But Washington didn't leave. He kept his army on Manhattan Island for 3 long weeks. Why would he do that? Well, I can only come to one of two conclusions. Either Washington was totally incompetent, which I don't think was the case, or possibly Washington was a man in the throes of a black depression. He had been under a terrible strain for weeks. He was utterly fatigued, physically and emotionally. "I am bereft of every peaceful moment," he said, "wearied to death all day with a variety of perplexing circumstances." He radiated telltale signs of a man in the grip of depression. "He had lost all comfort and happiness," he said. "I've never been in such an unhappy state. Such is my situation that if I were to wish the bitterest curse to an enemy on this side of the grave, I should put him in my stead with my feelings," he said. He wrote that he knew he would never get out of this with his reputation intact. He said that he felt betrayed by all around him. He shunned all responsibility, though, for the perilous situation in which he found himself. He admitted that he did not know what to do. "I do not know what plan of conduct to pursue." He seems to me almost to be harboring a death wish in late September and early October of 1776. "I am resolved not to be forced from this ground while I have life." And he spoke of going out in a blaze of glory, which would be a credit to the justice of my character. Well, Washington didn't go out in a blaze of glory. He survived, and for two reasons. Howe finally made his landing in October above the mainland, on the mainland, just as Washington had envisaged. But because he had poor maps and poor advice, he landed in the wrong place. He landed at a place called Throg's Neck, which was really an island, and he had to pull his army back, reload them on transports, look for another place to land, and 6 days later he found that place and landed his men at Pell's Point. During those 6 days, the second thing happened. General Charles Lee, Major General in the Continental Army, from Britain itself originally, so professional soldier for 20 years in the British Army before he resigned and immigrated to Virginia and lived in what is now West Virginia. Charles Lee, who had been in command of the Southern Department, hurried back, in fact, probably was sent back deliberately by Congress to help Washington at this point. And Lee took one look at what was happening in Manhattan and told Washington, get out and get out now. And Washington listened to Lee. He trusted Lee, saw him as his best advisor. And that seemed to be the wake-up call that Washington needed. And he gave the order for his army to evacuate Manhattan. And they got out literally one step ahead of the British, who finally made a successful landing at Pell's Point. But Washington did not take all of the army off of Manhattan. Curiously, he left 3,500 men at a place called Fort Washington that overlooked the Hudson. There was no reason to do so. Even Washington had acknowledged that because of British naval superiority, Fort Washington was useless. And he knew that the British were going to attack the installation. But as the attack neared, it fell to Washington to make the decision whether to evacuate that garrison or leave it there to fight. And Washington could not make the decision. He tried to decide. A day went by, 2 days went by. He was still trying to decide when the British made the decision for him. They attacked Fort Washington and in less than a morning overran the post, killing or taking prisoner all 3,500 men who were garrisoned there, most of whom, by the way, died in captivity within the next few weeks in New York City. Not only did Washington leave that post intact, but there was another post right across the river, Fort Lee in New Jersey. And Washington did not order, in the face of all of this, that it be evacuated. And the British attacked Fort Lee and took it. And with Fort Lee, they took 30 precious cannon, 8,000 cannon shot, 4,000 cannonballs, 2,800 muskets, 400,000 cartridges, 500 entrenching tools, 300 tents, and 1,000 barrels of flour. By this time, many people were beginning to question Washington, including General Lee, who spoke of Washington's fatal indecision. And so did Joseph Reed, Washington's first military secretary, and he really his closest confidant during the first year of the war. Joseph Reed broke with Washington. An indecisive mind, wrote Reed, is one of the greatest misfortunes that can befall an army. How often have I lamented it in this campaign? Well, Washington did recover after that, and at the very tag end of 1776 waged the Trenton-Princeton campaign, which is one of the great campaigns waged by any American military commander, a successful campaign that restored morale and enabled Washington to recruit a new army for 1777. But in 1777, things did not go particularly well for Washington either. And this time with potentially more serious consequences. Because back in 1776, there had been two American armies, Washington's and another army that invaded Canada, and both had failed. But in 1777, there were two armies, and this time, while Washington's failed, again, the other army succeeded. The other army was commanded by General Horatio Gates. It resisted General John Burgoyne's invasion of New York in the summer and early fall of 77, and scored America's first really great victory in the Revolutionary War at Saratoga, when an entire British army, an army that had started with 8,500 men, capitulated to the Americans. While Gates was winning this enormous triumph, a triumph that many historians regard as the turning point of the Revolutionary War because it brought France in on America's side, Washington was fighting the British at Brandywine. He brought his army down to resist General Howe, whose objective was to take Philadelphia. And Washington recapitulated many of the errors that he had made in New York. He failed to adequately reconnoiter the battlefield site. He fell for a feint by Howe, who tried again to flank Washington. And as information poured in on the day of the battle that Washington's army was about to be flanked and possibly destroyed, Washington had a very difficult time making up his mind what to do. He was indecisive again for hours, and only finally at the last minute did make up his mind and made it up correctly. But even then, was largely saved because darkness fell over the battlefield and fighting stopped, and Washington was able to extricate his army. A couple of weeks later, Washington tried to do what he had done at Trenton by pulling off a surprise attack on a large British force posted outside of occupied Philadelphia at Germantown. But he failed there, and he failed in large measure because of a decision that he made early in the engagement. The force that Washington was leading came upon a house called the Chew House, named for Benjamin Chew, who had been the Chief Justice of Pennsylvania, a large stone house. And a few more than 100 British soldiers entered the house. There was no reason to trouble with them. They could do very little to the American army, which was sweeping on in the other direction anyway, but Washington spent a precious hour trying to take that house. Three American regiments were occupied in that engagement. One third of the total losses at Germantown occurred at the Chew House, while only four British redcoats were casualties inside that house. And in large measure, because of that, Germantown, a possibly a winnable battle, was lost. And again, many officers were outraged. One wrote, "A glorious victory fought for and 8/10 won was shamefully lost by poor generalship." John Adams, still in Congress, which had had to flee Philadelphia and was now meeting in York, Pennsylvania, was in despair. Adams wrote in the aftermath of that campaign, "The prospect is chilling on every side, gloomy, dark, melancholy, and dispiriting. When and where will the light spring up? We have a good cause, as good a cause as was ever fought for. We have great resources. The people are well-tempered. What is needed to bring order out of this confusion and save this country?" Adams did not offer an answer to his rhetorical question, but others did. Dr. Benjamin Rush, signer of the Declaration of Independence while a member of the Pennsylvania delegation to Congress, believed that Washington was the cause of America's problems. Washington, he said, was inexperienced, confused, and indecisive. But mostly, he surrounded himself with sycophants and incompetent advisors. "New measures and new men alone can save us," he said. And Rush proposed that Congress choose a new commander of the Continental Army each year. John Dickinson Sargent, a congressman from New Jersey, said, "We want a general. Countless lives and dollars are yearly sacrificed to the insufficiency of our commander-in-chief." Washington had lost at Brandywine and Germantown, he said, through such blunders as would have disgraced a soldier of 3 months' standing. Abraham Clark of New Jersey, who also signed the Declaration of Independence, wrote, "Victory will be elusive until the management of our army is changed." And Thomas Mifflin, who had been of Pennsylvania, who had been Washington's first aide-de-camp, had seen Washington up close for 2 years, had seen enough. Washington's unjustifiable arrogance, combined with other causes, he said, are driving officers out of the army by the dozen. Men who would not worship the image and pay an undeserved tribute of praise and flattery to the great and powerful Washington were fed up, Mifflin said. And Mifflin proposed that Washington be replaced by General Gates, the hero of Saratoga. Well, Washington was, of course, not replaced that winter, though there were people in the army who criticized him. General Thomas Conway, a French soldier of 20 years' experience, wrote, "Heaven has been determined to save your country, or a weak general and bad counselors would have ruined it." And General Johann Kahl, or DeKalb, as we call him here in metropolitan Atlanta, also a member of the French Army who had served for nearly 30 years, wrote that Washington was the weakest general he had ever served under. And listen to this quote. I'll read it again at the end of my talk. "If Washington does anything sensational, he will owe it more to his good luck or to his adversary's mistakes than to his own ability." Well, Washington did survive despite the calls for his ouster. He survived for many reasons. I think many in Congress simply didn't want to cross that bridge of ousting Washington. It would cause a political firestorm. Others thought it was the wrong time. The army was in Valley Forge. It was in a precarious situation. To oust Washington might lead the entire army to collapse. France was indeed about to enter the war. Best to wait for French assistance. They would perhaps right things. But also, I think most congressmen saw good qualities in Washington. He was not a professional soldier, and he did make mistakes, but they didn't want a professional soldier. He was a good administrator. There was no hint of scandal in Washington's performance to this point. And he had led a sacrificial life through the first couple of years of the war. He'd stayed with the army. He had endured hard times with the army. He became something of a symbol of needed unity. Remember, this is America, the United States is the only country without a monarch in the Western world at this point. And Washington was something of the glue around which Americans could rally. And most Americans didn't know of those mistakes that Washington had been making. As Adam said, Congress kept those mistakes very carefully hidden from the American public. So Washington stayed on. And after Valley Forge and after 1778, the war changed. And we entered a phase of the war that now is largely forgotten. The British changed strategies. They had not been able to win the war in the North between 1775 and 77, and so they adopted what they called a Southern strategy. Their strategy now was to retake the four Southern colonies, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, and Virginia. Those were the most profitable colonies on the mainland in the British Empire. Those were the colonies that produced tobacco and rice and made great fortunes in the parent state. So they wanted to take those colonies, and if they could take those colonies, and if they held Canada and the American West, the British would come out of this war with a sizable American empire that ran from Canada through the West, through the South, included Florida, which they had taken in the French and Indian War, and on to the Sugar Islands that they had held for 150 years in the Caribbean. This would not be a total loss. Washington did not come south in 78 or in 79 or in 1780. He stayed outside New York during all of this time. In fact, Washington appears to have misunderstood the war in the South. When the British took Savannah in December of 1778, Washington poo-pooed the loss of that city, telling Congress that the reconquest of all of Georgia would contribute very little to Britain's war effort. And the British did go on to take other things. They took Charleston in 1780. In fact, they destroyed three American armies between December of 1778 and August of 1780. Three armies that altogether totaled about the same number of men that Burgoyne had lost at Saratoga. And Washington did not come south. Southerners began to wonder what was going on. The governor of South Carolina, an exasperated John Rutledge, complained to Congress about what he called Washington's scarcely credible tactics and trifling help, as he put it, for the Southerners. And Rutledge's lieutenant governor, Thomas Bee in South Carolina, even proposed or even suggested that if Washington has decided that the Southern states are meant to be sacrificed, Bee proposed that South Carolina negotiate favorable terms with Great Britain and drop out of the war. Nor were Rutledge and Bee Washington's only critics. Thomas Jefferson, the governor of Virginia, privately expressed doubts about Washington's strategic vision. "The northern states are safe," Jefferson wrote. "Their independence has been established since Saratoga." Yet that was where Washington kept the Continental Army. "Washington," said Jefferson, "was like Spain with Gibraltar. And like Spain with Gibraltar, Washington would be no more successful in retaking New York," Jefferson correctly predicted. What could Washington have done? Were there choices? Yes, there were choices instead of remaining inactive. He could have brought the army to the south. Or twice, Congress proposed an invasion of Canada. In 1778, when Congress proposed that Canada be invaded, Henry Lawrence, the president of Congress, said that only one member of Congress was opposed to the invasion. But Washington opposed it, and the invasion of Canada did not take place. Or when the British brought their army South Carolina in the winter of 1780, bringing their army from New York, General Henry Clinton, Howe's successor, was frightened to death that if there was a heavy freeze that winter and the winters froze over around New York, that Washington would attack Manhattan. And in fact, the rivers did freeze over, but Washington did not attack. And we know, in fact, that had Washington attacked, it was Clinton's plan to recall the army from South Carolina to defend New York. So what was Washington doing? Why was he inactive? Well, Jefferson, I think, hit on one idea. He was simply obsessed with New York. He believed that wars ended in one great climactic showdown. He wanted that to be New York. He thought that was the only place it could happen, and that was where he would gain eternal fame. There's another possibility, too. I think Washington, after 1777, was aware in his heart of hearts that he had made so many mistakes that he no longer trusted himself, that he no longer was willing to act unless there was a professional soldier by his side who signed off on the campaign order. And that soldier would be, of course, a French soldier after this point. But there were none around at this point. So how did things turn out for Washington? Why did they turn out so well for Washington? They turned out because of the forgotten war in the South. That's where the Revolutionary War was won. Southerners and most Americans remember the Civil War, but they don't really remember much about the war in the South from 1778 through 1781. But there was a great partisan war in Georgia and in South Carolina and in North Carolina. And General Nathanael Greene, who was sent to North Carolina to take command of the Continentals at the beginning of 1781, waged a brilliant campaign against Earl Cornwallis, the commander of the British forces. And ultimately, Cornwallis made a fatal mistake. Cornwallis, though he had been ordered not to leave the Carolinas until he subdued the rebellion, decided that he could not subdue the rebellion unless he first subdued the northernmost southern state, Virginia, cut off all the routes of supply to the partisans in the Carolinas. If he could do that, and only if he could do that, could the war in the South be won. So against his orders, Cornwallis, in May of 1781, took his British army, nearly 8,000 men, into Virginia. And that was exactly what the French commander who had arrived in America, General Rochambeau, had hoped would happen. Rochambeau had met with Washington at a conference in the spring of 1781, just about the time Cornwallis was moving into Virginia, though they didn't know that at the time. They met at Wethersfield, Connecticut. And when they began their talks, Rochambeau said to Washington, "What do you want to do?" And Washington said, "I want to attack New York." And Rochambeau said, "We can't win in New York. The British have had 5 years to prepare their defenses. It'll be a long siege operation. We can't win. What do you want to do?" Washington said, "Attack New York." And Rochambeau was under orders from Louis XVI to do what Washington wanted. So Washington left Wethersfield and returned to his army. And immediately when he left, Rochambeau wrote a letter to the commander of the French fleet in the Caribbean, and he asked the Admiral de Grasse to bring his fleet north, but not to New York, but to the Chesapeake. And so it was Rochambeau who baited the trap that Earl Cornwallis had fallen into, and that was, of course, Yorktown. And Washington got the credit at Yorktown. The French permitted him to have the credit at Yorktown. So let me remind you again what General Cobb, DeKalb, said. If Washington does anything sensational, he will owe it more to his good luck or to his adversary's mistakes than to his own ability. Washington, I think, despite all the mistakes, was the best man that America could have had to be its commander. He was a lucky man, too. And in the end, I think America was fortunate to have had him, but lucky to have survived him.